My mother mistakenly in Montgomery, the first time we lived, they were actually stationed there twice. She mistakenly sat on the colored only bench outside the bus station and was told to move by the people running the bus station. You know, that was a pretty violent and oppressive time, and things fortunately have changed. We still have a lot of work to do, obviously, but it makes you appreciate the progress that has been made.
Hello, and welcome to Dwayne Morris, DEI 360 with Joe West. I am Yumika Anderson Howard, Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Manager at the firm. Joining Joe today is Dwayne Morris partner, John Simpson. John shares with Joe his remarkable experiences and lessons learned from growing up as a military brat in the segregated South, having Ruth Bader Ginsburg as a professor, and living through the Civil Rights Movement.
Hello, this is Joseph West. I am a partner at Dwayne Morris. I'm the firm's Chief Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Officer, back with another fascinating interview of another member of the Dwayne Morris family. This guy is near and dear to me, both professionally and physically. We are right down the hall from each other. It's one of our partners in the trial group, John Simpson, here in the DC office. John, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good, man. How are you?
Great. So let's jump in, John. One of the reasons that I wanted to interview you is because of the absolute uniqueness of your background. I think if you started listing the number of trial lawyers who are number one, Harvard graduates who also happen to be Marines who served in Vietnam, who specialized at some point in animal law, it probably wouldn't take long to call the roll. Am I right about that?
I think that's probably true.
So let's jump in. Tell us about your educational background, first of all, and I guess that's interwoven with your military service as well. And first of all, thank you for your service. But let's talk about that. Well, you know what? I believe you're from a military family, if I'm not mistaken. Isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. I was what you would call a service brat. My father was an Air Force fighter pilot, and my three uncles, one served in World War II, and the other two uncles, one was in the Army and one was in the Marines. They both served in Vietnam. My granddaddy on my mother's side served in World War II. And it's interesting because he commanded a truck battalion, and he only made one trip to France in his life, and that was across Utah Beach in June 1944.
Wow.
And he took that truck battalion, which in those days was 100% African-American, except for the officers were all white. And he took that truck battalion all through Europe. They supplied gasoline and ammunition for the Ninth Army. They liberated Paris, and he had a section of his battalion cut off at Bastogne in the Battle of the Bulge. So, if anybody ever asks you, were there black troops at Bastogne with the 101st Airborne, the answer is yes.
Wow. They're
with my granddaddy's battalion.
That is absolutely fascinating.
So I grew up in a military family. I went to, before I graduated from high school, I went to 10 different schools in the Deep South, in California, in Ohio, and overseas 3 years in Germany. So I had a very diverse exposure to all kinds of different cultures and people growing up.
What were some of the places you lived, John?
Well, I spent most of my early years in the Deep South. We were stationed in Louisiana. We had a stint in Florida. We had a stint in Alabama. I was actually in Alabama in 1963 when President Kennedy was assassinated, and I was in the eighth grade. This is another story that it's kind of chilling, but, you know, I was a white boy, 14 years old, in the eighth grade in a segregated Montgomery, Alabama. And we were in eighth grade band class when an announcement came over the loudspeaker that I couldn't really figure out what was being said. But what I could hear throughout the high school, throughout the junior high school, was cheering.
Cheering when Kennedy was assassinated.
And so the band director stops and we're all listening. And then he read, the principal read the announcement again, and the place started to erupt in cheers. So it's kind of hard to imagine something like that happening today, but it was a very eye-opening experience to live in that environment where the town around the school was totally segregated. They still had white-only signs, colored-only signs. This was 1964. The Civil Rights Act hadn't been passed yet. But if you go on the Air Force Base, it's totally integrated. So totally different juxtaposition. We spent a significant amount of time in the Deep South, but also in California and Ohio, so, and overseas.
This is a fascinating perspective, John. I say that because I'm a son of the South, grew up in the Deep South. I'm a little bit younger than you are, but not a whole lot. And I have very vivid memories of whites-only signs, colored. I went to segregated schools until I was in eighth grade. My perspective, obviously, is a lot different than yours, but it's fascinating to hear you tell that aspect of the story from the aspect of a white person who kind of was experiencing and sort of having an understanding of what that looked like.
I can't begin to understand how a Black person experiences that. I'm not in any way to judge that, but it opens your eyes when you go to a restaurant and you see the person who owns it, and a Black kid comes to get something to eat, go around back. You can get something from the kitchen. You saw that all the time.
Yeah.
Or my mother mistakenly in Montgomery, the first time we lived, they were actually stationed there twice. She mistakenly sat on the colored only bench outside the bus station and was told to move by the people running the bus station. So, you know, that was a pretty violent and oppressive time, and things fortunately have changed. We still have a lot of work to do, obviously, but it makes you appreciate the progress that has been made.
Well, I can only imagine having experienced that and then having served in the military, what an interesting juxtaposition that was. Can you talk about that a little bit? And number two, what led you, other than the family tradition, what led you in that direction?
Well, I wanted to be a fighter pilot my entire life. That's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to go to the Air Force Academy. And if I couldn't get into the Air Force Academy, I wanted to go to West Point. And so, I worked my entire conscious life towards that. So once I got to the high school point, senior in high school, I applied for and got appointed to both service academies by Lyndon Johnson. I got one of the presidential appointments. But I realized that I didn't feel like I did well on the eye test because they kept searching for a lens for me to see through. So I told my father that, and he was a colonel at the time. And so when they came out to talk about me going to the Air Force Academy, he asked the guy, did he pass the eye test? He said, well, he's got good enough eyes to get in, but he's never going to be a pilot. And so, and just at that time, Harvard College sent me a letter. They sent a letter to all the top students in the area, the Dayton, Ohio area high school, saying, we'd like you to come see a presentation. So I went down to some hotel in Dayton and watched this film. And they said, why don't you apply? And my father, we discussed this. And he said, look, you're not going to fly. And the only reason you wanted to go to West Point was to get into the Air Force. So he said, why don't you go to Harvard? And I said, and he didn't, I didn't use this word, but you can imagine what the word was. I said, Harvard's just for sissies. And he said, and he looked at me and he said, you think John F. Kennedy was a sissy? So I applied and I got in and went and had basically decided I was never going to be in the military. But in those days, late 60s, early 70s, we still had a draft. I had a student deferment, but when they drew the names out of the fishbowl, the birth dates out of the fishbowl, my number was 18. So 18 means you're going to get drafted. There's no way around that. And I got, in my senior year, got a notice to report to the Boston Navy Yard for a physical and went down there. And I was the only college person there. They're all 17, 18 year old guys from Roxbury, from South Boston. And I reflected on that and came back and I thought, you know, and I thought about being very fulsome in my medical history because I'd had childhood asthma. And then I went ahead and disclosed that, maybe thinking maybe that would get me out of it. And then I found out that, well, asthma gets you out of being an officer, but not being an enlisted man. So then I had to go to the doctor to get a letter written so I could be an officer, probably the only person at Harvard that ever did that. The only letter that guy ever wrote to get somebody into the service as opposed to getting them out, right?
Wow.
So I, you know, I decided, look, I'm no better than those kids in that line. And what's the most dangerous thing the armed forces do? My perception was the Marine Corps. And what's the most dangerous job in the Marine Corps is a platoon leader. So I decided to, that's what I wanted to do. So I went to OCS and went through training and got assigned to 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, which is one of the most famous battalions in the Marine Corps, 1st Marine Division.
So I'm thinking about this aspect of your story, and I'm thinking about what you had been exposed to, the injustices that you witnessed, and I see a through line between those two. Do you?
Well, it was I come from a military family, so I was raised in the tradition that we're the good guys. You know, and as portrayed in The Longest Day, as portrayed in The Great Escape, that was the Cold War portrayal. And of course, everything in those days was being torn down and criticized and debated. My senior year, you had the Tet Offensive, which had very graphic images of dead Marines on stacked like cordwood, which shocked the American public unlike anything in history. And Walter Cronkite goes on national TV and says, we're not going to win this war. And within weeks of that, Martin Luther King Jr. was murdered in Memphis. And then Robert Kennedy was murdered in California. And during that same time frame, my uncle Butch Phillips, who was my mother's brother, had gone to Vietnam, had flown 300 and some odd missions with a medevac helicopter unit. And he came back and was assigned to train pilots in Fort Rucker, Alabama. And he was killed in a helicopter accident, training warrant officers to fly helicopters. And so his wife gave me his watch. That was my graduation present. So I went to Harvard in my pinstripe or my wingtip shoes and my skinny clothes and my Beach Boy haircut with Uncle Butch's watch on my wrist. And of course, as a military kid, there was probably only two other people that had military families. I was a total fish out of water. And of course, Vietnam was very hotly contested. There was a virulent anti-war movement.
Yeah, that's right.
The military was the bad guys, the baby killers. So
this is particularly the case on Ivy League campuses, if I'm not.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. And my first year, my freshman year, was interrupted with a strike where they took over University Hall.
Yeah.
And I had to watch they put like 500 crosses in Harvard Yard. Just about that time, you know, freshman year, second semester, I get a letter from my mother, said, your daddy's volunteered to go to Vietnam. And I'm thinking, like, who does that? Right. He was a lieutenant colonel. They never were never going to send him. But he was trained as a fighter pilot. He flew combat missions in Korea. He became a test pilot at Edwards Air Force Base when we were stationed out there. At the time, they picked the Apollo astronauts. He was eligible to be picked, but they had an age cutoff. He was 1 year too old. Yeah. So I have I have a longstanding sensitivity to age discrimination, because if my father had been 1 year older, there's a good chance he would have walked on the moon.
Wow.
But anyway, he goes off into some MOS that he didn't really care for, flying multi-engine aircraft. And when he got a chance to command a fighter squadron, he went. So he goes to Vietnam in 1969 and 70, and I'm at Harvard when all this anti-war stuff's going on. And I get draft number 18. So I'm angry about that. And I remember when we had riots on Harvard's campus, they sent the state police and local police in there with tear gas grenades. And I was out there in the street with all these hooligans throwing the tear gas grenades back to the cops. Could have gotten arrested, could have gotten hit with one of these things. And unbeknownst to me, at this same time, like within 2 weeks of this riot on campus, my father flew a combat mission in which he saved a convoy that was ambushed by a North Vietnamese unit. He personally led the attack and was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for that. And then I later find out after Nixon invades Cambodia and we have the Kent State shootings, and that leads to another strike, get another letter from him saying, well, while you're there at Harvard reading history, I'm here making it. And I find out he not only planned the air attack, he flew the first plane in.
Wow.
I mean, that was his mindset. If we have to go, I want to be first.
That's an amazing plot you cut out of. So were the two of you in Vietnam at the same time?
Well, I never went. I was post-Vietnam. By the time I got commissioned, Nixon had withdrawn all Marine Corps ground units.
Got it.
But I served in an environment where all the other officers were combat veterans, were Marine Corps combat veterans.
I got you. John, tell me about law school. How'd that come about? It's apparent how and when and why the military was part of your makeup. What about law school and the law?
Well, I'd always been interested in history and being a lawyer. It sort of sounded like there was a connection there because of precedent and having to, learn the cases and all that. But I also was impressed by some of the military lawyers that I'd met. So I decided to apply to law school while I was in the Marine Corps. I was admitted to Columbia Law School in fall of 1975. I'm pretty sure I was the only veteran in the class. That may have been one reason I got in, because they needed at least one veteran, right?
I'm assuming the Harvard degree and your smarts probably didn't hurt.
Well, it might have helped. It might have helped. I don't know. But of course, going from the Marine Corps to Columbia Law School at Amsterdam Avenue and West 116th Street is a pretty dramatic change in circumstances.
Yeah. Fortunately, your experience in Montgomery gave you a little bit to work with.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I actually gave a talk for our WINS group on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, but she was my civil procedure teacher. And it's interesting because I saw a lot of parallels between how she ran her class, which was she terrorized the students.
Really?
You needed to be prepared. But it was very similar to what I went through in OCS. In my so-called, they didn't call them drill instructors in OCS. They were sergeant instructors.
Yeah.
But our sergeant instructor was a guy named Napoleon Bonaparte Jackson.
Wow.
And he was like a badass Marine, but he was even more importantly, a badass black man. And he was very similar in terms of what the kind of pressure he put on you to see what you were made of. Very similar to what Ginsburg did. So I thought it was kind of an interesting parallel.
That is a fascinating parallel. John, I'm listening to you talk, and I think you have a book in you, my friend. I hope you're working on it.
Maybe, could be. Everybody's got at least one book, right?
I'm sure anyone listening right now is asking themselves to ask me to ask you what RBG was like as a professor.
She was... I wanted to be like her. I really did. And at that time, 1975 was like women were still a minority in just about every aspect of the law, law school, law firms, the government. And it never dawned on me when I went, having gone to Columbia and having her as one of my first instructors and therefore setting the example, it never dawned on me that women couldn't be effective lawyers. And when I got out of law school and heard that kind of talk at a firm that I joined that was headquartered in Houston, I'm thinking, well, you obviously don't know what you're talking about. And certainly you've never met Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, I wanted to be like her as a litigator, but in the kind of preparation she brought to the cases, because her view was, you can't change how smart you are. That's God given, but you can, you have total control on how prepared you are. And that's how she taught that course. And I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the experiences we had there. And of course, she goes on to become a famous Supreme Court justice. I actually had two oral arguments in front of her in the D.C. Circuit. So I had that privilege.
That's fantastic. I can personally attest to your work ethic and that ethos. Let's talk a little bit about, and you know, having worked on at least one matter with you, let's talk a little bit about your practice. We have about 5 minutes left. I want to make sure we give people some sense for John Simpson, the lawyer. You've been at Duane Morris since 2018, if I'm not mistaken, after having spent the entirety of your career at another firm. Tell us a little bit about what brought you our way, why we were fortunate enough to land John Simpson, and about your practice area.
Well, what Duane Morris, the firm I was with had issues, and they merged and became big and global and so forth. But what impressed me about Duane Morris was the collegiality that used to be in that other firm when it was like 300 lawyers. And Duane Morris had a small firm feel, but a big firm punch in terms of the kind of things they can do in the courtroom. And it didn't have litigators. It has trial lawyers. So it emphasizes we go to trial and we're not afraid to go to trial. And if we get to trial, we're going to bury the other side. So if you want to win a case that nobody says can be won, we are the people you hire. This is what we do, and we do it well. And that's kind of how I've looked at it. And that's how this firm looks at it. I regard myself as able to try just about any case. And my specialty is cross-examination of witnesses in a jury or bench trial. But when I was working with my colleagues, Michelle Pardo and Rebecca Bazan, we had a famous case for the Ringling Brothers Circus that we won in the district court here in front of Judge Emmett Sullivan and pulled basically chestnuts out of the fire for the company and won outright, got a huge legal fee award. So we took that one case in which the basic issue was, were these elephants, circus elephants, being properly handled under the Endangered Species Act? We took that one case and turned it into what's so-called animal law practice, which exists to this day. 10 years later, it's still vibrant practice in which we provide legal services for all manner of businesses that have animals, whether they're exhibitors, whether they are manufacturers of clothing, whether they're farmers. We represent that entire spectrum. And this is one of the only law firms in the country that does this. It has this specialty. It's maybe the only big law firm, you know, AmLaw 100 firm that has this practice that's on the industry side of it as opposed to the activist side of it.
I think there are two really important takeaways from that. Number one, just really to your point about being prepared and providing excellent service to the client. But secondly, being mindful of the opportunity that presented both to develop and expand what really was, I guess, a nascent, almost non-existent practice area.
Yeah.
And understand the ways in which there's some connectivity with what you were doing with sort of a broader constellation of opportunities.
Well, and it's always been my philosophy that you want to develop your own business, but you also want to help the law firm develop business.
Yeah.
And so your two most important clients or the relationships you have independently, but your other most, you know, equally important client are your fellow partners. So that when someone in the law firm needs help because they send an email, can you do that? Can people do this or that? Or someone offers up your name, you treat that situation just like it was a client calling you. You know, whatever it is, you drop and do it. You want to be responsive. You want to make sure that they get the support they need, particularly if you actually do have the skill, and not kind of back away from it or say, no, I don't have time. No, you make time for something like that. So those are two things that I've tried to guide my life by. Because ultimately, clients hire lawyers, not law firms, but they're going to hire law firms if they're filled with good lawyers that provide that kind of service and make them feel comfortable that you're the most important client they have.
John, I never like to wrap up conversations with experienced and accomplished lawyers, especially trial lawyers who are near and dear to my heart, without asking the question that I think benefits younger lawyers who might be listening. The profession has evolved and changed a lot since you've been practicing, since I've been practicing. What would you say is the most important piece of advice that you could give to younger lawyers, perhaps just starting out now in the profession, that might help sustain their career over a long time and benefit them in the profession?
Yeah, I think a young lawyer coming out of law school today needs to understand that this is not just a job. This is a profession, and you're held to a higher standard. You can't do things that other people routinely do. You need to do the right thing when nobody's looking, right? You know, if you find a wallet on the street, you need to find out who owns it and give it back. And that carries through how you handle yourself as a lawyer, as well as a human being. But your cases, you take a case and you've got to ethically handle that case. But you've got to, if you're a trial lawyer, you've got to be all in on your client's point of view. And you've got to empathize. You've got to, as we used to say, hug the cactus. And that means if they've got bad points, then you got to deal with them. And maybe you have to admit that they're there, but it's your job to win that case and be an advocate and a champion for your client, but also to be a confidant and a rational sounding board. Because if you get into a settlement situation, they're going to look to you, should we do this or should we not do this? And you got to give them honest advice. You can't just sit there and say, no, because you want the billable time, let's continue with the case. No, you have to do what's right for the client, but you have to. And that's why we're professionals. We're not just worker bees somewhere in a factory. We're professionals. And always
hug
keep
the,
it in mind.
Hug the cactus is going to be my new phrase that I've learned today. John, I remember when I first met you, when I interviewed you and Michelle Pardo, your partner at the old firm, who's now our partner here at this firm. I was so impressed with you as a person, as a professional. And every day that I've had the opportunity and the privilege to work with you, my respect for you has increased. I can't thank you enough for spending time and having this conversation with us.
I appreciate the opportunity, Joe. And I will say that meeting you was one of the main reasons I came here, because of all the firms we talked to and the firms I knew about had actually been in, Duane Morris was the only one that had institutionalized and put its capital behind a diversity, chief diversity officer. And that person took time to meet with us, because I mean, I'm a white guy. I don't need any protection, but there were two female lawyers making the move with me that had not had a good experience in the other firm. And so that was extremely important to understand that they weren't going to face those kinds of issues coming to Duane Morris. And you were critical in getting that point across. So I thank you for that.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, but here's what I want you to understand. Don't underappreciate the value that you bring to the diversity dialogue, both from the experiences that you've been kind enough to share with us today, but also from the perspectives and the background that you bring to bear, whether it's your military experience, the extent that you spent time juxtaposed between the segregation of the Deep South and the integration of the military, the knowledge that you have around issues related to race and gender and ethnicity are invaluable. And I'm so glad that you're a part of our firm.
Well, I thank you for the opportunity to talk with you, Joe, and I hope it's been helpful.
It has indeed. Thank you, John Simpson. I appreciate it. And we'll talk to everyone next time.
All right. Have a good day.
You too.